One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Big Game Week here on the pod. The Three Lions are on the march, and so too are the British and Irish Lions, after their 56-14 victory over the Hauteng franchise, also unhelpfully known as the Lions. The summer of rugby has started at home too, with England's Independence Day victory over the United States, Ireland being pushed all the way by Japan, and Wales cruising to a victory over Canada that was overshadowed by another serious injury to Lee Halfpenny. I'm Alex Lowe, and joining me to run the rule over all of that and to discuss his in-depth series on the 1997 Lions tour called Inside the Tour is Alistair Eakin, commentator and broadcaster extraordinaire, and two ruck regulars in Owen Slott and Stuart Barnes, who are pretty decent with a pen and a microphone as well.
That was a nice introduction, wasn't it, saying those nice things about us?
Yeah, I nearly put a line in about Lawrence being on holiday, but wasn't quite sure how that would go down.
Whenever I go away, even for a cup of tea, people have a go at me. So I think it's fair enough.
Did you have a good weekend?
I had a good weekend, Alex. Yes, I've enjoyed the rugby. I mean, I've kind of enjoyed the rugby. It's left a slightly funny taste in the mouth. I'm not quite sure what to make of it all, if I'm brutally honest, both with Lions and England in particular. But more importantly, I played cricket and scored some runs. So I'll take that for the weekend.
Well, how many?
It was only a gentle half century, but it was nice to get a few.
Yeah. I see. In a winning cause?
It's extremely high-level cricket in the Oxfordshire Leagues. League 8C, I think you'll find. We're tearing it up. You wouldn't believe the damage we're doing.
The last time you played cricket, Ali, presumably, was on the 2009 Lions tour. You got so badly injured, I presume you haven't been able to play again since.
I actually nearly killed myself that day. It wasn't the last time I played cricket. There's been a few games of cricket in between. But yes, that wasn't my finest hour. But I think it showed my commitment to the cause, because I was chasing a ball, for those who weren't present, to the boundary. And we're playing on this funny pitch, actually, in somewhere in the middle of Johannesburg. And it had kind of amphitheatre style seating. So the brick walling kind of went up from the boundary edge. There wasn't any space between the boundary rope and the seating, which constituted stone, basically, stone wall. And I was tearing off this ball, which I should have given up long ago. And I launched myself after it. And my knees got jammed in the dry grass as I landed. And I catapulted my entire body into the wall and collapsed like a sack of spuds. And I think a lot of people that day thought I'd done myself in.
I was standing elsewhere on the field, and I had given up on it. I thought it was just going off for four and turned away. And then suddenly heard this collision and groaning and turned back. And, oh, my God, it was horrendous. Yeah.
Yeah, I did scare a few people that day, including myself, actually. I had a bit of a panic attack. I was taken off to hospital for scans and stuff. There is a story about the scan, but it's sort of post-watershed. Well, this is not post-watershed. I was given a scan. I'll tell you the story. I was given a scan very quickly. They were brilliant in that hospital. I was told very quickly I was going to be all right. But they scanned me up and down, and the guy came in and said, listen, there's a couple of things I've just got to do to make sure we're absolutely fine. And there is a reflex system that you need to check if you've got any question of a spinal injury. And it involves fingers going in places that they perhaps oughtn't at different points. And he had just checked my teeth, so I had to ask the doctor whether he wouldn't mind changing his gloves.
Yeah, happily the outcome was a good one, and we could all get on with covering the tour, but it was a bit messy.
I remember hitting Will Greenwood for four, and then
that's enough, then, isn't it?
And you getting injured. Those are my two memories of the day. Shame we won't be able to be all back there playing cricket on this tour.
I know, it's very odd, isn't it? And you look at that game on Saturday with all those empty seats, and I suppose it's just extra difficult to stomach on account of the fact that right now we're watching all sport with, okay, not full capacity crowds, but it feels like it, and the noise is substantive to the point where you don't feel like it's a non-event. Everything that's happening around us now feels like an event. The Lions just did not feel like an event to me, and that's very, very sad when you know what it can be like.
Do we just accept that this is what's happened, or at some point our question's going to be asked about whether they made the wrong decision, didn't make enough of an effort to have to bring it here? I mean, I guess if it was here, it would still have been overshadowed by England in the Euros and Wimbledon and some of the big stories that have happened over the weekend, but I don't know, what do we think?
I don't think it's the location. I think it's the time. Wherever you went in the world, there were question marks. You know, my family live in Australia, and there was that plan, wasn't there, to go to Australia. That would be up in ashes now. The reality of it is that it should have been put back a year. I hate to agree with my dear colleague, Stephen Jones, but Jones has been banging on about this for quite a while, and I think he's right. And in the end, you look at it, and it looks to me pretty much like a financial decision. And we all love the Lions, but they wanted to get this tour done. And I think, contrary to what World Rugby says, it would have been comfortable to have tours next year and the Lions. And I think that's the problem. We're a year early. I've been thinking all year that this tour might not happen, or it might end up in tatters halfway through. And whilst I think it will get to its end, it's pretty worrying when Cyril Ramaphosa declares it stage four for COVID, and in South Africa, let's just say, well, maybe a bit like here, when the politicians say something, what they say and what they mean are not always the same. So it's very worrying, and I just think let's get on with it and really enjoy the tour now. But I do believe it should have been 1 year later.
I tell you what's worrying for me is the idea of Jonesy getting on a plane this evening for Johannesburg, and he's going to spend the next week with three meals a day room service not allowed out. I mean, the guy's half mad already, but what sort of a state is it going to be like at the end of that? And just in case anyone's wondering, I'm supposed to be going at some point very soon too, but I can't contemplate living like that, and so I've postponed. I'll be there in a week's time, I suspect.
If you go, you can go to matches as a journalist. You can get into the games, but everything else, every other dealing with the media, with the Springboks and the Lions, from what I gather, is remote. Is that right? So it's done by Zoom. So you benefit from being at the games live by going, but all the restrictions are so tight that.
Yeah,
there's a 9 p.m. curfew. There's no alcohol for sale, and everything's done remotely.
Can we just make clear that the no alcohol thing is the one area of guidelines that I expect every journalist to be able to find their way around. Otherwise, you shouldn't be there.
Yeah, big duty free purchases and a separate suitcase with some scrumpy in it.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, scrumpy. Yes, fantastic idea.
What did you make of the game, Slotty, on Saturday?
Oh, it was a bit ho-hum. I think the more I think about it, at the time you see lots of fun stuff like tries and fireworks and stuff, but the more I am the more it sort of recedes in the past, I just feel that it wasn't a proper hit out, that the opposition were okay but not great, their defense was really poor, and it's one of those ones where a bit like when you see England playing one of the November internationals against a lesser team, and a few people stand out, but you don't really know what it really means in the greater scheme of things. You know, if you've played well against the Sigma Lions on Saturday, if you've scored four tries like Josh Adams, that shows you're sharp to beat the Sigma Lions. But has it got anything to do with the Test series?
No, that's why today in the press I wrote about Elliot Daly. because Daly looked as sharp as we've seen him at 13 for a long time. But doing it against Sigma Lions is a complete irrelevance. Daly's question mark is, will he handle the power runners coming at him in that 13 channel? It's not been a strength of his. He wasn't tested. So I'm completely with Owen there. It's a little bit like the game that came, the game in Cardiff and the game between England versus USA. You couldn't knock anyone on the result, on the back of what happened. You couldn't go over the top. I mean, of all the games at the weekend, probably the one that stood out as the most interesting test match was, well, not probably, it was definitely Ireland versus Japan, where I thought everyone wrote Japan off and they gave a reasonable account of themselves again.
Yeah, can I just say, I know we don't like to be too kind to each other on this podcast, but I actually really enjoyed Barnsley's piece on Elliot Daly this morning. Anyone who hasn't read it, Barnsley was arguing, so it was, it's the Elliot Daly debate, you know, is he a 13 or is he a back three player, a fullback as Eddie Jones has had him? And many of us, like myself, have said that the fullback thing hasn't worked, but Barnsley's argued valiantly that it has. And then Elliot plays rather beautifully at 13 on Saturday, but you're still sticking with your guns, Barnsley. I like that.
Because Daly has to do it under pressure. God knows I love disagreeing with Eddie Jones. I've made part of a career doing it. Like, no, I'm not the only one. But I am prepared to say when I think he's right. And I think Jones saw something in the way Daly plays, and he's right. And Elliot has been weak under the high balls for a little while. And people then say, yeah, and he's missed tackles. But I tell you what, try saving tackles. They're headline stuff because everyone remembers them. But you have to make a hell of a lot more in that midfield position. And if you start missing them, your fullback is going to have to make a lot more, and you don't keep making them one-on-one.
I mean, that's the crux of it, isn't it, Barnsley? The style thing. You know, what exactly are we going to see from a Warren Gatland midfield? Because you look at the other centres in that squad, and by and large, and this is, you know, very broad brush, you know, they're extremely physical. They're battering rams. Yes, they've got some soft skills, but, you know, Bundy Aki and Chris Harris and Henshaw, you know, they don't have the outside break that Daly has. They don't have the outside break that Slade and Ringrose both have. And I just can't get my head around going on tour to South Africa without those two, at least as part of the equation, as an option. Daly's the only one of them who's got that out-and-out gas that can trouble defences on the outside in the wider channels. This is going to come down to a question of style, isn't it, from Gatland? What does he want from his midfield? And of course, that pairs up with who he picks at 10.
He wants the midfield not to take a step backwards. He doesn't want Dielende and Lucania Am dominating the game line that they did in the World Cup final. He wants to be able to keep Conor Murray and whoever's playing fly half just about on the front foot. I think if you look at the Lions' offensive game behind the scrum, most of it is going to come off the boot. They got in Bigger and Russell, two exceptional attacking kickers. And we know that if Farrell finds some form or blind faith sees him into the equation, he's got his array of rugby league chips and chases, which can be quite brilliant when he's on form. So I think the Lions, I never forget what the All Blacks said about playing them. Why do you want, Richie Mwanga it was, he said, why do you want to play into the teeth of this physical team when you can kick over the top and turn them? And once you start kicking and turning them, that's your only way of slowing their line speed down, because they have to worry about that. So I think it's a question of who you play 10 to get the creativity, and your 12 and 13 have got to be absolute rocks in defence, and probably your 10 as well.
Do you think Warren is employing the policy he's done on the previous two tours of giving everyone a start in the first three games to give them an opportunity to put their hand up for test selection. I just wonder whether that this time it's more about squad harmony with a shorter run up to the first test with fewer midweek games. I mean, 4 years ago, two players from the last midweek game played themselves into the test team. Do you think that he actually, although he's talking about giving everyone a start, to give them a chance, he's flown out there knowing his test team pretty much already?
He's got to have gone to South Africa with a pretty clear start and then, you know, can chop and change according to what he's seen. And I think that's what he will do. He said after Saturday's game, he insisted that he doesn't have an idea in his head of his test team yet, and he's not looking at that yet. But I think he kind of has to say that because he has to keep the players, he has to give all the players a sniff of the glory at the end of it. Otherwise, he's lost them from the start. One of the things that is a challenge for Gatland is from the two games we've seen, no one's really had a bad game yet. And in one sense, you sort of, if you're Gatland, you want some people to count themselves out of the equation. Now, that's in part due to the fact they played Japan and now the Sigma Lions, so they've had comparatively soft opposition. So no one's played themselves out. The Sunday Times yesterday made me laugh. They had that thing when you go, who's gone up and who's gone down in terms of test contention. But in terms of who gone down, they picked Wynne Jones, who's a really good scrummager, and said, well, he didn't do much ball carrying. Well, that's kind of not what he's there for. And then they picked Lewis Rees-Zammit, who got like one touch and scored a try, but because he was on the wrong wing from Josh Adams, who got four, he's apparently gone down in contention. So it's just really hard. The only player who I think hasn't really played particularly well is Owen Farrell, but I think we all know that Gatland will give him at least one more chance.
Is this part of the issue that the Lions face going forward in terms of the strength of the opposition for the tour matches? Because I've noticed this time around that they've started to be referred to as warm-up games or even practice matches got rolled out at the weekend. And sure, when you went on that 93 tour, and Al, when you were researching and doing your pod for 97, those weren't warm-up games or practice matches. Whether they were full-bore tour matches against strong opposition who were absolutely like hungry to take the Lions down.
The essence of a Lions tour has changed dramatically. It's now all about the test series because, dare I say, I say this as a former Sky employee, worker for Sky, Ali at BT, we know that the big bucks are test matches and everything is geared towards the test game. And, you know, in 93, I can recall, you know, when you play North Auckland and then the Maori and Otago, these were huge games. The Maori game, they called it the fourth test. There's nothing like a fourth test here at all because everything is geared to giving the Lions. And by the way, you know, the Lions are involved in this. They don't want those games. They want to be ready for a test series and nothing else. And it does require a bit of marketing ingenuity to convince everyone that, you know, every game is big. It's not. It's about three test matches. It has changed. In 2017, I recall, Auckland Blues were playing the Lions and they'd had a pretty rubbish old season as they tended to do at that stage. And I was talking to their manager, Tana Umunga, a day or two before the game. And I said, you know, would this really save your season if you beat the Lions? And he said, no, we went to Fiji and I think it was Queensland Reds. We beat them and in Fiji there, a bit of marketing as well. That was a big game for us. That was the one that mattered. This is nothing but a bonus. And I dutifully didn't write that up because I just wanted to sustain this myth. But the reality of the Lions now is three test matches and we can pretend as much as we like. But that's why you get this scorched earth policy.
But Barnsley, how's that? In 2017, the games before the test were serious games. The Lions got beaten by the Blues and the Highlanders. Are you saying that it's better preparation for the Test series to have a series of soft games against these South African teams that are denuded of their best players? I would have thought it would be better to have the kind of prep that they had in New Zealand where they got beaten up, they lost games, they were really tested, they really had to rise to the challenge. And by the time they got to the Test matches, they knew exactly who they were, how big the challenge was and how to take it on.
Well, two things there. One, I think that 2017 tour was a reminder that New Zealand has a strength in depth in its rugby like no other. That Blues game, they did not field their full 15. They rested a load of players and they beat the Lions. And nowhere else, South Africa can't do that. So I think there's that aspect to it. But there wasn't the essence of that tour was about three tests, and you could feel it burning through. And when you would talk to Warren Gatland after the games, there was no, oh my God, we've lost to the Blues. Oh God, the Highlanders have beaten us. It was okay. We lost that game, but it's all about moving on. Now, I think New Zealand warm-up games are more helpful for Lions than ones against weakened South African opposition. I agree with you fully there, Owen, but I think there's a degree to which the South Africans, they did it last time. The last time this tour was in South Africa, 12 years ago, we had some awful opposition. If you remember, there were cricket matches everywhere.
And Warren Gatland referenced that, didn't he, post-match on Saturday. He's very aware of what happened in 2009. Mm. You mentioned those cricket schools, Barnsley. I mean, the first couple were not competitive remotely. And I mean, they beat the Sharks by, 39-3? I'm looking at it here. You know, there were a lot of big scores and they didn't learn an awful lot. And then they got suddenly to the test arena where the whole thing is different. And the box are ready and waiting. And it's almost as if they're luring you in. They're giving you a sort of false sense of security and then wallop. It's a completely different sport.
Al, anyone who picked up the Times' Lions pullout on Saturday would have seen an excerpt from your pod, latest episode with Ian McGeachan and Jim Telfer in conversation, sort of discussing exactly this, how you pick a Lions team. What did you learn from piecing together your series inside the tour about the challenge that these guys are facing out in South Africa at the moment?
Can we just massage Ali's ego for a minute? It's a bloody good series, by the way. You know, if you've got any time beyond listening to this podcast, it's well worth listening to that. Now, off you go, Ali.
Thanks very much, Slotty. You're very kind to me. It was a lot of fun to make, apart from anything else, because everybody has such amazing memories of it. It's so fondly remembered. The characters were, I mean, so special on so many different levels. Ridiculous personalities that came through that tour, and of course we all feel like we lived it and breathed it. There were obviously many people who were there at the time. Barnsley, Slotty, I'm sure you were there in some part as well, but actually for most people it was the video, obviously Living with Lions, that brought it to life for people. And I think probably in putting together this podcast, I was very keen not to lean too heavily on the film, because we all know what happened in the film, we know all those stories. I really wanted to unearth a few more from behind the scenes and just get to know the characters a little bit more. So many of them went on to achieve so much in the game and beyond. You think of those players there, you know, Keith Wood, Lawrence Dallaglio, Johnson, Scott Gibbs, Doddy, obviously, Will Greenwood, you know, so many huge personalities. Talking about the Geach and Jim episode, I mean, that was a treat because they actually hadn't at the time spoken a great deal to each other, and certainly not about this topic in that environment. So it was almost a case of asking them one question and then picking up, you know, an hour and 10 minutes later once they'd finished having their chat, which was the really lovely thing. And actually that illustrated one thing to me, which was the chemistry between them was incredible, really. And I think, you know, we see coaching teams being put together all the time, don't we, at a club level, international level. You can have a really fantastic head coach, but if he doesn't have the coaching staff underneath him that he really trusts and respects and can delegate to, then his brilliance as a single guy at the top isn't going to count for an awful lot. So their chemistry, I think, was absolutely pivotal. Geach, obviously, the master planner, and Telfer, the man who put it all into practice on the training ground and had a wonderful means of communicating. Well, they both did, of course, when we talk about their speeches. But the tactics and the style, it was forensic in a way that I think probably previous Lions tours, Barnes, you might tell me otherwise, I think previous Lions tours had not been so forensically planned. They were picked broadly on national lines, who was playing well for England, Wales, Ireland, Scotland, and can we then fit them into our unit? This was a case of how do we beat South Africa first? What type of players do we need to do that? So they've got the framework of the jigsaw puzzle and they fitted the players into their jigsaw puzzle as opposed to the other way around. And that I thought was really interesting. It was the first Lions tour that wasn't picked by committee. So, you know, you did have some pretty extraordinary picks at the time. You know, the likes of Will Greenwood obviously hadn't played for England at that point, an uncapped Lion. Obviously, Rob Howley was the leading contender at nine, but Dawson, you know, he was something of an outsider at that point, but of course, huge connections with Northampton and McGeechan, and there were a lot of Northampton players on that trip. So the blend of it all just worked really well. But I think because of that crossover between the amateur and professional era, it was obviously at a very interesting period for rugby. You had the rugby league influence, the likes of Scott Gibbs and John Bentley, Scott Quinnell and Alan Tate. And so these guys brought a different sort of element to training, a different sort of professionalism. And it just seemed to be the tipping point, really. And obviously, we're still learning, aren't we? Rugby union is still learning how to be professional. But there was an awful lot to learn. And I hope, actually, in the podcast, one of the things I hope more than anything, really, is that you get to know the characters even better than you feel you know them already. Little things that certainly my ears picked up when I'm learning about things like Geach taking the test side off on a Friday afternoon for cream tea. You know, that's not what I expected to hear from him about the perfect preparation 24 hours out from a test match. Learning about Fran Cotton calling up Martin Johnson's mum because he can't think of anybody else who knows Martin Johnson better than her, just to get a reference point as to whether he would make a good captain. Listening to Jim Telford talk about Geach and Cotton at that very first press conference in South Africa in 97, where they met Steve Chwete, who was the sports minister, who'd spent time in Robben Island with Nelson Mandela in 1974, listening on their radios to the Lions series in which Geach and Cotton were both playing. And wow, the impact that he had on him. And of course, at that point, they were cheering for the Lions as South Africans locked up in a cell under the apartheid regime. So it's all those sort of little bits that I hope we've brought out and have brought to an old audience and a new one with any luck. But the proof will be in the pudding, I guess. But it's been amazing to me.
Yeah, just hearing those stories just underlines how just a million miles away that one tour is from this tour. You know, the idea of being locked up in a pub or going for cream teas or any of the rest of it. They can't even get out of the blinking hotel.
No, I think that is going to be a problem for them, isn't it? I mean, I think there are some similarities, by the way. I mean, quite obviously the opposition is one. And, you know, the Lions are going to have to solve the problem of the scrum, just like the Lions of 97 had to solve the problem of the scrum. And that's something that we got into quite in depth in Inside the Tour, particularly with Keith Wood. Over the scrummaging sessions that Jim Telfer held, which of course were legendary, but particularly the tactics about how you parity at least with such a powerful pack. Warren Gatland is going to have this same conundrum. England had it in the World Cup final. And I think we all know that in 97, they used those squat, smaller scrummagers in Tom Smith and Paul Wallace. But what that did was, without teaching everybody here to suck eggs, they were basically using their power, the box power, against them. It wasn't a question of overpowering them. It wasn't a question of even trying to take them on at their own strength. It was a question of negating their power to some degree. They scrummaged so low that they were asking the box to try to hold their own massive weight under enormous strain at a very, very low level. And what that allowed the Lions to do was, at least after they'd worked it out, and of course it then provided them with a platform to do the things that they did behind the scrum. And so I just wonder, when you hear Keith Wood saying, oh, you hear all the experts saying, well, you've got to match the box up front before anything else happens. You've got to fight fire with fire and match their power with your own. He said, ever since 97, I have not subscribed to that view. You've got to think smart. You've got to think outside the box, unless you have that power available to you. If you have, well, fine, fill your boots, try and take them on. But very, very few people can manage that. I'm not sure the Lions have that capacity. The Lions are 21. But I think that's one of the interesting talking points if we're relating 97 to 21.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
So the Lions team play on Wednesday is kind of expected, but when you look at it, it makes you ask questions. So Liam Williams at fullback, Watson, Daly, Aki, Van der Merwe, Bigger and Gareth Davis halfback, Mako Vunipola, Luke Cowan-Dickey, Xander Ferguson, Ian Henderson and Adam Beard in the second row, and then Josh Navidi, six, Tom Curry, Sam Simmons. So you sort of expect that. The subs are Owen, Sutherland, Furlong, Byrne, Conan, Murray, Hogg and Harris. So I don't know what you guys think, but the first thing I'm thinking is he hasn't named a second 10 on the bench. So presumably if there was a problem with Bigger, then Elliot Daly would fill in there, but that's not really the point. But I'm now thinking if Farrell and Russell aren't playing on Wednesday and Bigger is, then when's Farrell ever going to play outside Bigger? Or that's just the problem with the way these games come so fast is you're running out of time already to try new combinations.
Well, even more than that, I think the one person who'll be really disappointed with that is Owen Farrell, because we've been told that he is a 10 and 12. Now he doesn't get a start there. So we're into game four. He then has to have another game. I cannot believe that no matter how much faith Gatland may have in him based on 2017, I can't believe that he's blind to Farrell's form for the last year plus. And I can't believe if that's the case, if he thinks Farrell is a potential 10, he has to give him more game time, because what Farrell needs now, you know, He's been in the wrong league, so to speak, in England. So it's been inside centre for England. Saracens, he's been at a level where it really doesn't matter. He's just run him out of time. I mean, to me now, it's you're starting to look already, I think, like Bigger with Russell on the bench and maybe Farrell at 12 to come on goal kicking. I out of all those 23, Owen, Farrell not playing at all there is quite something, I think.
So for the Saturday game, he could play Farrell at 10. He could play Farrell Henshaw at 10-12, which is another permutation which you could see Gatland playing with. But if Bigger has another decent game on Wednesday, then I can't really see how he doesn't get the starting shirt.
Bigger and Henshaw, that looks to me like a first test partnership in the midfield.
So I'm just looking at the fixtures here. So obviously the next Saturday game is the Bulls. And then South Africa A, when we think there may be some of the Springboks made available, some of them, is on the 14th. Stormers is a week before the first test. So at what point do you think he will have to sort of settle into that system where the Saturday team is the test team, which usually there's a slightly longer run up to it?
That Stormers game will be what he'll want that as his dress rehearsal for his test team. And he clearly will make some changes thereafter, but he would like to get that as right as possible.
More than the South Africa A game 10 days earlier.
So that's a really good point. He could actually make that South Africa A game as his test team run out and then give the Saturday against the Stormers as a sort of last chance. Because then if you have a good game against the Stormers, you've got a whole week. Yeah, that's God, once again, Alex being smart there, isn't he? Well done. He's worked the whole thing out.
Alex, is that the drill then? They're expecting that South Africa A match to be significantly stronger than the Stormers are the following Saturday?
The Box have picked a 47-man squad, which covers the A game as well. So I don't think it won't be the full test team, but there will be players from the Box squad involved in that game, if not all of them, but maybe not the test team. So I think it's interesting that it's a midweek fixture and not a weekend game. But that's certainly the way they've been talking. Razi Rasmus was when he picked, I think, 47, 48 players.
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
And with the idea that he would oversee that squad for the A game and then release some and have a trimmed down squad for the test series.
Yeah, that South Africa A game will be their toughest match, I think.
So he'd want the Shadow Lions test team to be playing in that. He'd want an idea, you'd think, of his first 15 by that game.
Alex, I don't think it'll be a Shadow 15. I don't think we'll see such a thing. I think what we'll see are combinations through the tour, and then it all adds up to the whole. And yep. That's sort of, for example, Bigger and Henschel. And then maybe for the A game, whoever, if it's Harris at 13, Harris comes in and joins them and just building blocks through it. Front row, second row. One day we'll have the pack or maybe just the back row. I think, was it you, Ali? We made the point earlier about perhaps the Lions' biggest tests are going to be in the build-up to the series against themselves. And over the years, we've heard more and more coaches have talked about the imperative of high-quality hit-outs in camp, behind closed doors, against themselves. And I think the Lions, I think it's feasible that we won't see the Lions test team until the first test, unless you can find your way through the there won't be anyone around. What used to be the well-protected training camps to watch them train.
Yeah, I think that's quite likely by the sounds of things. I mean, this is partly imposed on them by COVID and a reduced schedule and the fact that, you know, under normal circumstances, if you have anything like a normal structure of a Lions series, you have plenty of time, don't you, for everybody to get a first start, for everybody then to settle into their combinations and for those combinations to be, by and large, quite well tested by the time you face the test team. But they just simply don't have that luxury on this tour. And as a consequence, they're going to have to be a bit smart, aren't they? They're going to have to think on the hoof and they are going to have to do what they can in amongst themselves. And maybe some of their toughest opposition will come in, other than that South Africa A game, maybe some of their toughest opposition will be midweek against each other, which seems kind of ridiculous. But that's the nature of this tour.
Alex, you were at the England game on Saturday. Any players in that team that you're thinking, God, they should be Lions?
Well, on that criteria, I mean, Sam Underhill was head and shoulders, I thought, the best player on the field. He looked like an established top-class international. He gave England power and ferocity at the breakdown and all those things that we know Sam Underhill brings. But as we discussed right at the start of this conversation, it was one of those games that's hard to make a judgment on anyone, really, that England capped 12 players in the match, the most they've capped in one match since the first game after the Second World War. And there were some players who did play well. I mean, I thought Harry Randall took his shots. I thought Freddie Stewart at fullback just looked classed, unruffled, confident. Marcus Smith looked confident, obviously playing a slightly more measured game than he has done for Harlequins. But And the USA were determined, and they scored four tries and would have taken a lot out of it as they prepare for some World Cup qualifiers coming up. But from an England perspective, I asked Eddie Jones afterwards how he wants players in this summer to put their hand up for selection in the autumn and then through to the World Cup. And really, you'll only judge the success of this summer by how many make it into that autumn squad and stay beyond it. And I asked him after the game how he can really judge whether anyone's done enough in these matches. And he confessed that while it was a nice day for England, there's nothing you can really tell about a player's potential to be a sort of a seasoned test match player until they've actually done it when the hot water's thrown at them, as he said. And this was he said they had some mild tepid water thrown at them, and they came through scoring seven tries.
Can I also just say, Alex, since when has Eddie used the autumn to blood players? He doesn't. I mean, Eddie is, last autumn, he just picked his powerhouse players. He's a little bit of history reinvention there, I think.
Well, I take your point. I think what he's trying to do this time is evolve his team a year earlier than he did before the last World Cup. I guess what I'm saying is if they think Freddie Stewart is a potential World Cup fullback, then they'll have to include him in the autumn. You know, there's no point picking all these new players now, picking none of them in the autumn and waiting for the Australia tour next year to then take a few youngsters. And so I think that's where this judgment will have to be made. Like, I think Harry Randall, I think Freddie Stewart, I think Marcus Smith, I think those guys will break into that senior squad when all the Lions are back. And there may be one or two others who emerge. You know, next week, Alex Dombrandt will play. Maybe Ben Curry will get a chance to start. But I did think, again, Henry Slade was just not as dominant and influential as he is at Exeter. And he's won, 40 caps now. And I'm still watching him play for England and think, I'm waiting for those games that he takes control of, and we see the best of him. And even on Sunday, I didn't feel we saw that.
Alex, early in his career, when everyone was bigging him up, I used to write about Henry Slade and say he's clearly a wonderful talent. He's got it all, but I've never seen him perform for Exeter and thought man of the match, because he has never dominated games. Then he went through this period in England where he did, and he's fallen off again. Because I would say on Sunday, he wasn't ubiquitous. He wasn't the man pulling the strings as you'd expect with all those caps. But some of his touches, kicking, passing, were delightful. And him and Marcus Smith in the midfield, and I know it's the USA, but they just pulled them out of position quite beautifully. But it gets back to what you say there. You want Slade now to do more. I was disappointed, not with the quality of his performance, but the quantity of his workload, because I'd have thought he'd have wanted to come out there and say to Gatland, if you like, you've left me behind, look at this. But it didn't happen. He just settled into the pattern that was imposed by England and did his bits very well. But they were, as it was at the start of his career, bits and not the whole thing that we saw for a couple of years in the lead up to the World Cup.
He did have an extra workload of having to help Dan Robson positionally. You know, Robson spent an hour playing on the wing, and he did a lot of direction. I see him communicating a lot outside him with Dan Robson to help guide him through some of the positional elements that he's obviously not used to. And interestingly, Dan Robson's last two caps have come at fly half and on the wing for England. But I agree with you, Baz. I just thought, you know, there were some lovely passes particularly in behind their wing who kept flying up. Some lovely touches, and the potential with Randall, Marcus Smith, Henry Slade is enormous. You would just like to see him take a bit more ownership, I guess, is the word I'm looking for.
You probably need a little bit more time together, don't you? I mean, it's the same with the Lions. They need those combinations to be playing together reasonably regularly to see the best of them, first and foremost. And secondly, they need the freedom to do what they do. I mean, one of the refreshing things to see was Randall doing what he did with that sense of adventure and ambition that we see every single week, the fizz that he brings to Bristol every time he's on the field. I felt he did, I know he got charged down, but he broadly speaking brought his game to an England shirt. Where I think in the past, and I think this is true of Henry Slade, I think it's true of Dan Robson. Robson's really not had an opportunity to bed in. But I think a lot of those guys, they feel cowed by, as Barnsley was saying, the imposition of the patterns, the imposition of the Jones game plan. Now, if you're going to pick Marcus Smith at 10, you've got to play Marcus Smith's game. You can't play an Owen Farrell game with Marcus Smith. You know, you can't expect Farrell to play a Marcus Smith game. So I think England have to evolve according to their personnel. And if you see Marcus Smith getting a decent run with England, you are more than likely to see the best of the likes of Henry Slade, because they'll be freed up in a way that they've been shackled to this point for the most part under Jones.
And we'll learn even less next week in a way, because Canada are weaker than the USA. So you know, England should be expecting to hit more than a half century of points next week. So it'll be another case of trying to work out whether, you know, whether Dom Brandt charging through everyone is a sign that he's ready or not. I mean, that, you know, those games are of lesser intensity than the Premiership final, which is actually a much greater indication of whether these players have it at the highest level.
Agreed.
You said, Alex, that the main thing that Eddie will learn most about these players is what they've been like in camp for 5 weeks. He'll have seen more of them in camp and on the training paddock than against the Americans and the Canadians.
Yeah, I think he'll see that as his big value, is spending 4 or 5 weeks with the next generation of players, and he'll learn more from what they do at the Lensbury and Pennyhill Park than at Twickenham, I think. Well, we'll gather here in a week's time and dissect the next England game against Canada. The Lions will have played twice by then. Gents, thank you very much. Al, thanks for coming on. Now you've reached the end of this pod, listeners, you should tune in to Inside the Tour. It is a brilliant listen. I think how many episodes are out now? Four or five episodes in?
We've got 5 out and 5 to come. Yeah, so we've got the test matches to come. We've got an episode on the film. We've got an episode on the injuries. 2 tests and then a Doddy Weir special episode as our final. It's a kind of tribute to Doddy and everything he did in 97, winning our hearts then, and of course still doing that now. Birthday yesterday, turned 51, and he's raised more than £6 million for the Motor Neuron Foundation that he has, which is just incredible. So inspirational bloke. So very happy to have him on and pay tribute to him in our final episode.
We'll be back on Thursday with Stephen Jones live from lockdown in Sandton, Johannesburg, to review the Lions' next game, which is on Wednesday. So everyone, thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll talk to you again in a few days' time.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.